Our guest contributor today is James Giles, who's George Galloway's election agent in the upcoming Rochdale by-election, and I spoke to him earlier via Skype. Welcome to the show. David, I mean, do you think the Labour Party are going to pay an electoral price at the upcoming general election?
Oh, I certainly hope so, and I believe that's the case as well. I mean, the extraordinary thing about what happened in Rochdale, where their candidate was removed for having a slight difference of opinion or emphasis with the Zionist talking points, is amazing. I mean, if you or I were in the Zionist war rooms and we said, this guy's said something vaguely off colour, shall we get rid of him? What would we say? We'd say, no, he's our candidate. Yeah. I mean, who else is going to defeat George? And they've destroyed their own chances there. And, of course, that's going to mean probably a victory for George in Rochdale. And, of course, there's all sorts of pushback going on against the Labour Party. I mean, the debacle in the House of Commons about the vote on the ceasefire, which, of course, is entirely 100% Starmer's fault, is a real indication of how far they're willing to go, to not just to push the Zionist entity's lines, but to actually take briefing from the President of Israel on matters of British parliamentary democracy. I mean, it's a real indication of the way in which Israel runs this country.
Sure. Well, I started by asking James if he felt that Labour had eaten itself effectively in Rochdale with their fake anti-Semitism codswallop.
It's quite unusual, isn't it, to have a campaign where pretty much every other player has left the field. Labour left the field with Azar Ali, who said some very silly things. The Green Party left the field. Their candidate also said some very, I'm going to call them silly things. The Conservative candidate is on holiday in Egypt and won't be back until polling day. And as for Simon Danchuk, well, he was disgraced long before this by-election. So I think all of the other parties have eaten themselves, which is part, although not in full, why we are now the bookie's favourite to win in Rochdale. Well, look, if you'll forgive me for speaking candidly, Labour put forward a shortlist of two candidates. Azar Ali, not a Rochdalian, someone who lives in neighbouring Lancashire, and Paul Waugh, the Eye journalist, who actually is one of my constituents here in Kingston-upon-Thames, where I'm the leader of the opposition. He, of course, was born in Rochdale, but has lived in Kingston for some time. And it was a choice between Azar or Paul. Look, I wasn't at the Labour meeting, but dare I say, they knew George Galloway was going to stand. I think Azar Ali was picked in a rush, largely to appeal to, so they thought, the sizeable Muslim population in the constituency. And just look how that has blown up in their faces.
David, I mean, with your victory in the courts and now this in Rochdale, I mean, do you think we're seeing a kind of a vindication of sorts for all those people that have been smeared for all these years?
Well, of course we are. I mean, the last 4 or 5 months with the ongoing, very, very visible day-by-day genocide by the Zionists, that everybody now knows that the stuff that I've been saying, that many others have been saying about Zionism being racism, everyone knows this is true now, and no one has anything really to say about it. The Zionists just respond by coming up with lies. Oh, Hamas did this, Hamas did that. And they're even being satirised about it on TikTok by thousands and thousands of young TikTok users. So it's very clearly a vindication for all of us who are anti-Zionists. And but it's not just that. It's also the beginning of the end of Zionism, I think. Zionism as a project looks extremely unsafe now, and it's very, very difficult to see how it can win anything from this. It may stagger on for another few years, but it looks like it's the beginning of the end for the Zionist project as a whole.
Yeah. Well, I then asked James, what sort of George Galloway's day-to-day schedule was like in the run-up to the Rochdale by-election?
Well, look, no 2 days are ever quite the same in Rochdale. George will wake early and finish late, always in the office, no later than 9:30, meeting voters, meeting business owners, meeting stakeholders, going out and fighting for every last vote, often not finishing until midnight. You must forgive the slightly scruffy state of me at the moment. I also fall into that trap. I haven't had time for a haircut, and most nights I don't finish until 2, maybe 3 a.m. together with a loyal band of volunteers. But that really is the beauty, if you like, of a by-election. But all I can say is, thank God it's only, what, 4.5 weeks long? Well, look, there's a wide number of issues in Rochdale. The media have been obsessed with Gaza, with Palestine. And, you know, rightly, a good section of the population have that as their primary issue in this by-election. But what the media aren't reporting is that the campaign is speaking out on a whole host of issues. Would you believe you can't be born in Rochdale? There's no maternity unit. You can't die in Rochdale either. There's no A&E. So we're campaigning to reinstate maternity services in Rochdale. Would you believe the town hall has had £20 million spent on it, yet the clock still can't tell the correct time on the town hall? I think that epitomises the state of the local authority in Rochdale, where youth services have been cut to the core, where they can't even find a bucket of tar to fix the seemingly endless number of potholes. I think if I could sum it up in one way, I would say that people are disillusioned with Labour locally, disillusioned with the Tories nationally. They're fed up of the political class, which is why they're looking afresh at George. I'll end my answer to this question, I think, with this. The day before Azar Ali was suspended as the Labour candidate, the pipes burst in the Labour HQ. True story, I promise. And excrement was spilt from the pipes all over the leaflets of Azar Ali, an omen, if you like. And I think that is also the epitome of how Labour have run the town. There's excrement everywhere. The services are terrible. I would use the SH word, but I won't end it and I won't say it because it's not broadcastable.
David, just say a word or two, will you, about Wes Streeting and his links to the Zionist lobby. And do you think Leanne Mohammed could actually beat him in Ilford North, where she's been selected, obviously, to field a, you know, an insurgent campaign similar to what George has been doing in Rochdale?
Well, as we heard in the film there, Streeting has had contributions to his office costs from Trevor Chin, who is a well-known Israel lobbyist and, yeah, of course has
mentioned
been,
him on the show
has
many
been
times.
Attached directly to Starmer's staff. Effectively, he is the most senior officer of the Zionist movement in the UK, has been for some decades. And also, of course, from Lord Mendelssohn, John Mendelssohn, who, of course, was involved in the first Labour lobbying scandal under New Labour back in the late 90s. And of course, he's also involved with charities which are funding the IDF, Jewish supremacist organisations, indeed settlements in occupied Palestine. So we know that kind of link. But look, Wes Streeting was recruited to the Zionist movement many, many years ago when he was still in the National Union of Students. He travelled to the Zionist entity at the expense of the Ministry of Foreign Affairs and took part in the Global Forum for Combating Antisemitism, the body which constructed the weapon to use against the left, which is fake antisemitism, the alleged identity between antisemitism and anti-Zionism. So he's effectively been recruited by the Israel lobby for many, many years. And that's his position.
Sure. Well, I also asked James about George Galloway's Workers' Party fielding more candidates in other constituencies.
Well, look, prior to this by-election, the party had already announced it was fielding 50 candidates in seats across the country at the next general election. If we win in Rochdale, and I believe we will win in Rochdale, I'm quite sure the party will explode in a good way, unlike Labour's candidate who imploded. I'm sure the party will see a flurry of new members, a flurry of new branches and a flurry of new activity. And so who knows where that current 50 seat promise could end up.
Well, I'm just going to pause the discussion there for a moment for our second report. This one's about the role of the Labour Party leader, Sir Keir Starmer. He's vying to become the Prime Minister of the United Kingdom. Yet on occasions, he seems to be prioritising Israel's interests over his own country's.
There were mass walkouts.
Westminster is known as the mother of all parliaments. But a recent attempt to vote on a ceasefire in Gaza seems to have been brought down by the underhanded skullduggery of Israeli assets within its halls. The SNP-drafted motion was scuppered by a last-minute intervention by Labour leader and pro-Israel enforcer Keir Starmer. Having consulted Israeli President Isaac Herzog, Starmer devised his last-minute plot to ruin the motion. The services rendered by Sir Keir Starmer to the genocidal Zionist entity are legion. All the way back when he was the director of public prosecutions, he played a suspicious role in protecting Israeli war criminal Zippy Livni when she visited London. An arrest warrant had been issued for her in the UK due to her key role in the Zionist massacre in Gaza in 2008 and 2009. While the issues were still up in the air, Starmer met with Israeli State Attorney General Moshe Lador, and 2 months later, Starmer blocked the prosecution of Livni. The leadership campaign to push Starmer to the top of the Labour Party was bankrolled by Israeli lobbyist Trevor Chin. So Chin is the president of one of Israel's national institutions, the UJIA. He's also on the executive committee of Israel's largest lobby group in the UK, Vicom. Since becoming the leader of the party, Starmer has hired a former Israeli spy from the military intelligence unit 8200, Asaf Kaplan, to perform the function of social listening for the party. Labour has also accepted a £5 million donation from Gary Lubner, who has also funded the United Jewish Israel Appeal, one of Israel's four national institutions. The Speaker of the House, Lindsay Hoyle, who collaborated with Starmer on this plan of sabotage, is also very close to the Israeli regime. He travelled to the Zionist entity with the Israeli ambassador to the UK, Zippy Hotevli, and waxed lyrical about the need to support Israel in its genocidal war on Gaza. He had also previously boasted about his father, MP Doug Hoyle, being one of the founding members of the Israeli embassy proxy, the Labour Friends of Israel. It seems democracy was aborted in the mother of all parliaments with an operation hatched in Tel Aviv.
David, just say a bit more, will you, about Lindsay Hoyle and his links to Israel.
So we saw in the film there his trip with the pro-settler extremist ambassador, Zippy Hotevli.
After October 7th,
yeah. After the launch of Al-Aqsa Flood. So that there's an indication. He went with Labour Friends of Israel, obviously, and he has a long history with Labour Friends of Israel. And he, of course, has also, as he said, has boasted about his father's role in the creation of Labour Friends of Israel, which is actually, let's remember, back in the 1950s. It was created before Conservative Friends of Israel ever was, an indication of how long and how deep that goes back in Labour history. And of course, Doug Hoyle was a Blair henchman, and that indicates to us, you know, the Zionist grip on the party is extremely tight, and you can barely move in the Labour Party in Parliament now for people who have some kind of connection to Labour Friends of Israel or to the Zionist movement. It's extraordinary.
Well, I asked James what he made of the fact that both the House of Commons Speaker and Deputy Speaker in the British Parliament are friends of Israel.
Well, look, it's my wholehearted view that the role of the Speaker and indeed the Deputy Speakers is to be non-partisan. I'm aware, obviously, that the Speaker and one of the deputies were Labour MPs. They, if you like, lose their party affiliation once they take the roles. But they shouldn't be engaged in any party political pressure groups, nor should they be friends of any organisation that shows loyalty to anyone other than the House of Commons. Their job is to uphold the constitutional precedents, conventions, rules in this country, and that is the only institution that they should be showing loyalty to.
David, why, in your opinion, do you think we should be concerned about Sir Keir Starmer hiring Asaf Kaplan, who, as we know, used to work for Israel's unit 8200, for, what did he call it, to undertake social listening for the Labour Party?
Well, I mean, this is one instance of very many of the infiltration of former, you know, 8200 operatives in British public life, in business, and also in politics. And so, of course, you know, the question is he still involved with Unit 8200? Is he still loyal to them? Does he have any contacts with them still? What is the role of Unit 8200 in the Labour Party? And more, what is the role of this social listening person in spying on Labour Party members? Where does the membership data go? Does it go back to Tel Aviv? And of course, those are the kind of questions that you would want to ask. But these are not the only concerns that there are. I mean, in the same office, it seems, until recently, was a guy called Ben Sofa, who has a senior role in the Palestine solidarity campaign, and that's a real, real concern as well. I mean, no one seems to be asking those kinds of questions.
No, indeed. Well, James has been a student of British politics for some years, so I asked him if he thought Britain's political elites had ever been as pro-Israel as they are today.
Well, this is the age of the political nobody, in part due to the constricting party system we have in place. If you go back 30 years, MPs were well-educated, articulate, knowledgeable, and were freer to speak their mind on a whole host of issues. These days, if you call for peace among both Israel and Palestine, as a Labour MP did, before Labour came round seemingly to that view, sort of, maybe, if not really, you get suspended from the party and therefore practically thrown out as an MP at the next election. There is a groupthink mentality that has become very prevalent in both main parties, and it really lowers the standard of political discourse in this country, and the public are worse served for it. There's no freedom of expression, freedom of debate, freedom of speech in the House of Commons anymore under the party whip system. If you speak out, you get thrown out, and that really isn't how it should be.
Well, David, I wonder what you make of Andrew Feinstein, the former ANC Member of Parliament under South African leader Nelson Mandela, standing against, going up against Sir Keir Starmer in his constituency. I mean, can he really win, do you think, there?
Well, what we're seeing here is really a replication of what happened after the invasion of Iraq. And I always quote the example of the Scottish Parliament in 2003, the elections there, where seven Greens and six Socialists were elected. That was a quarter of the whole Parliament was elected on the anti-war vote in Scotland. Mm. Now, it was a proportional system, so easier there, and sure, so it'll be harder here. But there's a real possibility. George may win in Rochdale, Leanne may win in Ilford North, and Andrew Feinstein, I think, has got a fighting chance here. The question is how much more anger there's going to be and whether they can dissipate any of the anger. It looks like most of their attempts to dissipate the anger so far have only exacerbated the anger. So I think, you know, we have a good chance of having some serious victories here.
Mm, well, it'll certainly be interesting, for sure. Well, my final question to James was how he responded to those who claim that insurgent campaigns like George Galloway's in Rochdale and elsewhere in the country are simply empowering the Conservative Party.
Well, no party owns their voters. No party owns their electorate. Labour activists, Conservative activists, Liberal Democrat activists often throw at new candidates, insurgent campaigns, oh, you'll split the vote, you'll let Blair in. Look, our voting system in this country is pretty goddamn awful. I'm a full believer in proportional representation. But the notion that Labour owns the votes that we will undoubtedly win in Rochdale is for the birds. Every vote has to be earned at every election, one vote at a time, and that's exactly what we're doing in Rochdale. Well, look, they say it's the squeaky wheel that gets the grease, and I think anyone that has ever followed proceedings in the parliamentary chamber, whether they agree with George or not, knows that he's capable of doing far more than squeak. And let us not forget that George's views, especially on the Gaza issue, are held by a vast swathe of the British public, a large majority. Share the view that George has. And that is a voice that is not being represented in Parliament, with a few exceptions. The SNP group have been strong, but it is wholly weighted in favour of a view that very few people hold. And so I think a win in Rochdale ensures a springboard, if you like, for hundreds of independent candidates coming forward. Leanne Mohammed has already come forward, Shoka Adam in Leicester South. There'll be hundreds, I think, of independents, progressive independents, standing up against this duopoly that it currently serves nobody in Britain.
Well, finally, David, I mean, you know, if George does win, it looks like he's in with a good chance of winning in Rochdale. I mean, what difference do you think he will actually make? Look, he's only one person in the British Parliament. I mean, will it be significant? How will he shake things up, do you think?
Well, of course it will be significant. I mean, as everyone knows, George is one of the best political orators in the country. I've known George for some considerable years, of course, from Glasgow, way back in the day, and he's been a big supporter of my work, and I've spoken on platforms with him on many occasions. Of course he'll shake things up, but it's not only about George, it's about what we build upon in relation to that. And of course the insurgent opposition has to be to push back against both major parties, to fundamentally change their stance and to wean them away from the racist and genocidal Zionist movement.
Mm. And I think it will certainly give a boost, I guess, to other insurgent campaigns around the country if he does win. But I'm afraid, anyway, on that note, we're going to have to leave it there because we are out of time. So let me thank our guest, James Giles, and of course our resident expert, Professor David Miller. Palestine Declassified will be back next week with more forensic investigations and analysis. So until next time, this is Chris Williamson saying bye for now.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing of our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Welcome to IRIB English Radio, where we explore the Islamic upbringing of children and youth, guided by the wisdom of the Holy Quran and the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt. Today, we are honored to have Sister Salma Khalfan, who is a distinguished Islamic researcher, with us to shed some light on this important subject. Assalamu alaikum, Sister Salma. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Alaikum salam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thank you so much for having me over.
Thank you so much for being here. So we've been discussing in the past few episodes about a certain question. A lot of the listeners must know it by now, where a parent wants to know what to expect from their teenage son and how to train for that so as to not be too late. And you gave some very important points, you know, truthfulness, trustworthiness, teaching them to be grateful, and instilling self-restraint and control, and last of all, you mentioned about instilling focus, and so that they are not so they shouldn't lose concentration so easily. And you gave some ways to do that as well. Do you want to say more about that?
No, I guess I'll go to another point, and that is determination.
Okay,
child should be determined. Determination is that will to do something, to gain something from it, to achieve something.
Yeah.
So, you know, from a young age, we should set goals for them. For example, if we are doing something, what is our goal? You know, like if we are reading, our goal is to understand the story. Once we've understood the story, our goal should be probably writing and explaining about the story.
Mm.
If that is there accomplished, then our goal is to follow the good points of the story.
Yeah.
So, in any way, if you go and see, setting goals is, nobody does things just like that. Even if the people don't have a religion, they would never waste the time doing things that, you know, without determination. Some people, of course, but if they set their goals, it's just be haywire their life. So
you need to have like a path of, you know, goal,
a path,
a focus,
and then a focus on it. That's why you talked about focus first, a determination that lead you to your goal. Something that you don't lose your hope. Like, for example, we should learn, actually, a scholar said this, it's quite funny, but we should learn determination from Shaitan. He never loses hope to misguide.
Yeah.
How strong he is to misguide, and he will never lose, even a pious person, he will feel, no, this can be, he or she can be still misguided. So, if you go and see the prophets, 1,24,000 prophets, out of them, the ulul azm means that irada, that determination, were five.
Mm.
This is Ibrahim, Nuh, Musa, Isa, and the Holy Prophet. They were the ones who faced so many difficulties but didn't lose hope.
Yeah.
They moved around and they accomplished their tasks. So whatever we do, like, you know, in life, for example, even if it be playing a simple game when they're small, then you should tell them our goal is to learn this from this.
Yeah.
Or when they grow up, studying, what is the goal behind the studying? Maybe the first thing would be maybe passing just with good marks. But then what is in the long run what? Then you should speak to them about the reality so that when they grow up, they're able to realize themselves without you telling them what's your goal.
Yeah.
They would be able to choose and select their own interesting subject that they would benefit, you know, the people,
definitely,
the society.
And just knowing that, you know, they've come here for a reason, I think this is one of the main kind of ways to tell the people that it's not possible for this world to just come just like that, and we've just come here just like that.
Exactly.
Without any goal, it makes no sense at all.
That's right.
So we're just going to take a short break and we'll be back soon.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
So welcome back to IRIB English Radio, where we have been discussing about how to instill some very important characteristics in our children so as to, you know, help them grow as better youth. And we've been discussing about instilling determination and will, you know, showing them how to set goals, showing them that this world has a purpose and everything in their life should have a purpose.
That's right.
Yeah, so do you want to expand
on that? That's beautiful. That we should not forget to tell them that why we came in this world, there's a purpose behind it. And then we should be determined to go along and fulfill that purpose. And not just think that, you know, that all these things that are required from us, for example, Sharia, are just like that to please God.
Yeah.
To please God, why? Allah gets pleased, He needs that pleasure? No. It's just for our own growth, our own success, our own pleasure, our own perfection. So when determination has been found in the person of everything, then he will come to know the purpose of life.
True.
And he will live in a very beautiful way. So teenager is at that age that he gets the most pleasure out of good things. So this is one of the best things to realize, to get the knowledge, to get that, that understanding of why we came. And he will derive the most pleasure out of obeying Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
True.
And we want that to happen, right, for all the teenagers. So the parents should, from first, set up these kind of goals in any activity that they're doing and remind them gently and politely, and therefore the child will grow up to realize that even everything that he sets up, he is there even in this life for a particular purpose, and he has to be determined to achieve that goal. And the goal is nothing but the closeness to Allah, qurbatan ilallah. So that comes later on. You know, when the teenager just realizes that everything has a goal, that motivation even comes about. And then when he realizes that his religion also has a divine goal for him, then he will take utmost pleasure in that too.
Very true. And especially right now, the youth, they're so goal-driven but unfortunately, because they're not being guided towards the correct goals, they are having very, you know, idealistic, materialistic kind of goals, that very materialistic, like worldly. So I feel like at this moment to kind of, nudge them towards the correct path, toward the correct goals, because they have so much potential, they can, like, you know, reach such great heights. So
that's right.
At times I feel like, just, you know,
like if you go and see the history of our scholars,
Yeah.
They were very young when they were so determined, and like at the age of tender age of 12, they were studying like religious Hosa.
Yeah.
Okay, we think that Hosa is something, it's so difficult. It requires so much determination. Sometimes you lose hope, you know, that you can ever grasp those kind of, you know, concepts.
Even the martyrs, like they at such a young age, they would still feel like they want to go and, you know, fight for what's right. They were,
despite the fact that they didn't have the strength also.
Yeah.
But they had such determination that they were not even refused to, and then they gave up their lives, and they remembered. Like if you go and see a young martyr of 12-year-old Shahid Fahmide,
yeah,
how determined he was that Imam Khomeini says he is our rahbar, he is our leader. Because he showed that he wanted to save the lives, and he went under the tank and he saved so many other lives.
Very true. So we're just going to take a short break and we'll be back soon.
Ya muqiyal khayrat, ya muqiyal khayrat.
The Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam said, a righteous child is indeed a flower from the flowers of paradise.
يا مقي الخيرات يا مقي الخيرات.
So welcome back to IRIB English Radio, and we have been discussing about a very important characteristic to instill in our children, which is our determination and will. And you know, you said that it's for the child's own benefit and growth, and we have to try and kind of show them how to set goals, how to, you know, what path to look forward to and what things to be determined in so that they can actually succeed in life and grow. So do you want to add more onto this, or do you have another point?
Yes, I have another point to discuss, and that is from a young age, avoid idle talk.
Mm-hmm.
See what's going in the family. If, for example, if the mother is smart enough, she won't idly talk to even the father.
Yeah.
Whenever she talks, there's something useful she's saying. There's a hadith that says that if you talk, the moment if you're silent, you keep on getting the reward.
Yeah.
The moment you talk, you either get good reward or you get, like for example, you get a punishment. Or for example, evil is recorded in your book of deeds.
Yeah.
So it's either sawab or guna, you know, a sin or a good deed. So talking useful things is a good deed. You don't have to keep on talking. And it makes sense that if you, it doesn't mean that you have to keep on talking. Okay, for a child, you have to keep on, you know, like, kind of you have to talk more. When they're cranky, you have to talk to them. When they don't want to sleep, you have to talk to them. When they want to play, you have to talk to them. So it's a lot of talking for the parents.
Yeah.
And you get tired. But the thing is, this will help in the long run. Everything makes sure that a parent talks should be useful. That should be in the upper list of our talking, you know, like a agenda. Like whatever we talk, make sure it's useful. Even at home, we set an example subconsciously when you're talking. That, oh, for example, if you're talking about people, it's like doing hibat, number one. Number two, it's idle talk. Or we're talking just about, for example, a TV program. It doesn't need to be even, you know, like discussed so much
but,
about.
But they say at times that it's good to just have a bonding time where you're just joking around and all, because when everything seems too serious, then the friends, then
yeah,
the children feel like, oh, we'll go outside.
Yeah, yeah, no. That seriousness, I don't mean serious.
Yeah.
I mean talk for a purpose.
Mm.
So you know that this is bonding time. So you joke, you laugh. But make sure that you don't talk idle talk. Okay? And when there's time to, for example, even if you talk about, for example, something that will make a child laugh, know that the jokes shouldn't be like vulgar jokes.
Mm.
They shouldn't be jokes that have no meaning. Even Imam Ali used to joke, you know? And
yeah,
the Holy Prophet used to joke. They have so many jokes recorded. And good ones. Intelligent jokes.
Yeah.
That made them laugh. You know? So it's important, yeah, to have this light humor, everything. But
has to be
something
some
that is doesn't have a purpose is no use to,
mm-hmm,
you know, to have a talk about. So anything, for example, even if it's lighthearted, the newspaper, what we read, what we learned, you know, without being serious, you know, like watching together something and having a conversation about what we learned from it, it's good to,
yeah,
even there, yeah, in the midst, you can even crack a joke or something. But make sure that
Like, we don't have to be in both extremes.
You know, that the purpose is not lost. Yeah. The purpose of gaining something from the talk is not lost. Definitely. So even if it's like gaining a good relationship with a child, and you know that this is your purpose, so you have to talk a lot. What did you do? Where did you go? All these things are very much, you know, like intricate. So
yeah,
still they should be done.
Very true, very true. Inshallah that we all refrain from idle talk. I think it's sometimes we get carried away when we're having like normal discussions or talks, you know, with our families, with our friends, inshallah. So thank you so much for your valuable time, and we hope to see you in the next episode. Thank you, dear listeners, for listening. And this was IRIB English Radio, where we had a discussion on child upbringing. If you want to listen to our programs or get more information, you can log on to parstoday.ir/en under the tab COI, which is Call of Islam. And if you type in Call of Islam Radio, you can find it on YouTube and Instagram. And you can also email us on englishradio@irib.ir. God bless you all.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way.
Join us in this journey. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Allah, 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 Allah.
اون چیزی که انسان را مطمئن می‌کند
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Imam Khomeini's historic speech outlining the state of affairs of the course of the revolution. Date January 23, 1983. Topic: Importance of propagating Islamic culture. Brothers and sisters of the various faiths should join hands. The programs must be prepared based on the perception and culture of Islam. I hope that with the strong heart and warmth that you have, you succeed in the job you are doing. Today the country belongs to yourself. Today everybody knows and understands that they are working for themselves, for the future of their own country. Put your trust in Allah, for whatever we possess is from Him and are for His servants.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners. Welcome back to IRIB English Radio. This is the Spring of the Truth, and I am Bita, the host of today's episode. We're going to start with this sentence from Imam Khomeini, the founder of the Islamic Republic of Iran and its revolution. If a person is full of knowledge, even if one has a good command of Islamic techniques, and even if one understands monotheism, but one is not purged and purified, still one will cause harm to oneself, one's country, one's nation, and to Islam. No benefit will be achieved. Man cannot construct others unless he himself is constructed, and the country cannot be constructed if others themselves are not constructed. So this is like a vicious cycle. If you cannot perfect and construct yourself, then you cannot construct another person. No matter how much knowledge and how many techniques, how much virtue you think you have, it doesn't benefit the society or the country and the nation. The human being's passions are not limited to 1, 2, 3, 10, or even 100. The human being's greed is also unlimited by taking one country, two countries, or 10. The prophets were assigned to limit them, to bring them under control, to control this unleashed animal who believes in no limits. If this creature is left alone and free to itself, and if one is not trained, one becomes so unleashed that one wants everything for one's own sake and seeks to sacrifice everybody for oneself. The prophets were assigned to bring them under control and to give them some criteria. So, the whole point of this speech is that if you feel that you are full of knowledge, you're good-mannered, and you're decent that, it doesn't mean that you are free from all the animal desires that you have in yourself. Don't forget that beautiful verse of Holy Quran, that we know you better than what you think, and we know all the dark suggestions that your soul makes to you, because we're nearer to you than your jugular vein. And I think here, the point is, the whole world is not ultimate goal before the prophets. Rather, it's a path to the followed to reach the destination, which is the high grade of humanity. If a creature reached that high human grade, one will achieve a happiness which is not limited just this world. The ultimate goal is the world behind this one.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Every night and every day, never forget to say, La ilaha
It's April 17, 1917. British forces launched their invasion to capture Palestine, still part of the Ottoman Empire. The battle goes on for 3 days. The casualties on the British side are mounting. They have to retreat. London then recruits Arab tribes, promising to help them shake off the yoke of the Ottomans. With their assistance, the British raid and destroy Ottoman supply lines and logistics in the Palestine region. On the first day of November 1917, the British forces mount a new round of invasion on Gaza. Lack of ammunition and supply cripple Ottoman defense line. Gaza falls into the hands of the British, and by December 1917, they take Al-Quds, but never honor their promise. Instead, the British occupy Palestine until 1948, when they hand over the Holy Land to the Jews flooding in from across the world. The Palestinian plight and the struggle for liberation begins. On May 14, 1948, General Alan Cunningham, the last British High Commissioner, left what was known then as the Mandate of Palestine. John Marlowe wrote of the last few minutes of British rule in his book, The Seat of Pilate. The Union Jack was lowered, and with the speed of an execution and the silence of a ship that passes in the night, British rule in Palestine came to an end. On the same day, David Ben-Gurion announced the establishment of Israel. It came as a shock to the Arab world. Several Arab countries joined forces to expel the insolent newcomers, but faced a crushing defeat. A neo-colonial project. Israel systematically took over Palestinian lands, expelling people from their homes and leaving many to live as refugees in isolated enclaves. Official records conservatively estimate that back then, at least 750,000 Palestinians were forcibly removed from their homes and lands by Israeli forces, resulting in the capture of 78% of historic Palestine. The remaining 22% was divided into the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. The displaced Palestinians entered a state of diaspora, with many spending the rest of their lives in refugee camps. In addition to the conquest of major cities, approximately 530 Palestinian villages were destroyed, and around 15,000 Palestinians lost their lives in a series of large-scale atrocities. Crushed and crestfallen, the Arabs vowed to wreak revenge, take their stolen lands back, and restore their lost pride, honor, and glory. With the rise of Pan-Arabic Gamal Abdel Nasser, hope and enthusiasm came back among the Arabs. A coalition of Arab states was formed to go to war with Israel on June 5, 1967. This time around, Israel overwhelmed the coalition in less than a week. The decisive victory included the capture of the Sinai Peninsula, the Gaza Strip, the West Bank, the old city of Al-Quds, and the Golan Heights. The Arab countries' losses in the conflict were disastrous. Egypt's casualties numbered more than 11,000, with 6,000 for Jordan and 1,000 for Syria, compared with only 700 for Israel. The Arab armies also suffered crippling losses of weaponry and equipment. The Six-Day War also created hundreds of thousands of refugees and brought more than 1 million Palestinians in the occupied territories under Israeli rule. The defeat demoralized both the Arab public and the political elite. Pan-Arabism was defanged and hopes to take back Palestine were shattered. The Palestinian issue remained unresolved as an Arab problem. Israeli Prime Minister Golda Meir famously claimed in an interview with the Sunday Times on June 15, 1969, that there were no such things as Palestinians. They didn't exist. Almost a decade later, in 1978, Egyptian President Anwar Sadat and Israeli Prime Minister Menachem Begin signed the Camp David Accords, according to which Egypt would recognize Israel as a legitimate state. A stab in the back of Palestine. Betrayed by Egypt and abandoned by the rest of the Arab world, the Palestinian nation was withering away under the illegal, brutal occupation. Two countries away from Palestine, the Iranian people were making history by toppling the powerful regime of Mohammad Reza Shah, who, like the Israelis, had the United States on his side. The fall of the Shah, who had the biggest army in the Middle East and the fifth greatest one in the world, rekindled hopes in the hearts of the Palestinians. The invincible could be vincible. In the words of the co-founder of Hamas, Abdulaziz Al-Rantisi, "We believe that the Islamic Revolution of Iran has had a positive impact on other Muslim countries. It has awakened them, and I believe this awakening accounts for uprisings across the Muslim world." The newly established Islamic Republic was, however, more than a role model for the Palestinian nation. Iran ended its alliance with Israel overnight in favor of the Palestinians. Just 6 days after the victory of the Islamic Revolution in 1979, the Palestine Liberation Organization chief Yasser Arafat led a 58-member delegation to Tehran. As the first official foreign politician to visit Iran, Arafat was warmly received by thousands of Iranians chanting in support of Palestine. "When someone goes to their home, they do not need permission," Arafat told the public during his visit to Tehran. He declared, "Iran's revolution is a great victory for Palestine. When I entered Iran's airspace, I felt like I entered the airspace of Beit al-Muqaddas." Tehran turned the Israeli embassy to the Palestinian embassy and renamed the road in front of it to Palestine Street. An act of symbolic importance. At the same time, founder of the Islamic Revolution, Grand Ayatollah Sayyid Ruhollah Khomeini, designated the last Friday of the holy month of Ramadan as Quds Day, calling on all Muslims across the world to mark the day annually in solidarity with the downtrodden people of Palestine. It was a message to the whole world. Palestine is not just an Arab problem. With this spiritual assistance from the charismatic leader of the revolution, Palestine was saved from oblivion. The Palestinian plight came to the foreground, a new lease of life for Palestinian fighters to keep on their uphill battle against the occupiers. The two major Palestinian resistance groups, i.e. the Palestinian Islamic Jihad Movement, PIJ, and Hamas, officially announced their existence in the 1980s. As an underground movement, Islamic Jihad had been found in the late 1970s by Fathi Shaghari, a young physician and a Gaza refugee. Endorsing the Islamic Revolution of Iran, Shaghari said, "This revolution was a wake-up call to us all that our victory is contingent upon following Imam Khomeini's path. So it behooves us to avoid all other ways except the way shown by the Imam in our fight against the occupation regime of Israel." Tehran's ties with the Palestinian resistance groups developed steadily, even when the Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein waged one of the bloodiest and longest wars in the region against Iran. Iran's closer cooperation with the Palestinian groups began in 1987 after Israel expelled Hamas and Islamic Jihad leaders to Lebanon as part of its efforts to suppress the Palestinian national leadership in the occupied Gaza Strip and the West Bank. The raging war against Iran failed to distract the nation from the Palestinian cause. The Islamic Republic expressed its deep disagreements over the so-called Reagan peace plan and the Fahd peace plan, where the rights of the Palestinians had been almost totally ignored in favor of the Israeli regime. Inspired partly by the Islamic Revolution, in December 1987, the Palestinian people staged a sustained series of protests, civil disobedience, and riots, which later came to be known as the First Intifada, or the Stone Intifada, as they were still throwing stones at Israeli soldiers who were armed to the teeth. Amid the deafening silence of Arab leaders, Tehran lent all its support to the Palestinian cause. Imam Khomeini took a clear, strong stance, saying with the Israeli regime in place, the Palestinians would not see the end of their sufferings. In 1993, Fatih Shaghari told Newsday, "Iran gives us money and supports us. Then we supply the money and arms to the occupied territories and support the families of our people." To draw further attention to the pain and suffering of the Palestinian people, a couple of years after the victory of the Islamic Revolution, Iranian pilgrims began staging demonstrations against Israel and its major supporter, the United States, at the Hajj. Perhaps one thing that sparked the flames of the First Intifada was a tragic incident that happened that year in Mecca, Saudi Arabia. On July 31st, 1987, during one of these pro-Palestinian demonstrations, the clash between Iranian demonstrators and Saudi security forces turned bloody, resulting in the deaths of more than 400 pilgrims. Hamas, an acronym in Arabic for Islamic Resistance Movement, emerged out of the First Palestinian Intifada in 1987. It was co-founded by Sheikh Ahmed Yassin and six others, originally as a local offshoot of Egypt's Muslim Brotherhood. On May 2, 1998, Hamas, still a fledgling group with less than a decade since its formation, paid a visit to Tehran to meet the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei. The meeting happened when almost none of the leaders of the Arab world took the Palestinian Intifada seriously. The leader of the Islamic Revolution, however, had a different opinion about the struggle, the group, and its leader, Sheikh Ahmed Yassin. Iran pledged financial support and provided the group with advanced military training at bases belonging to the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps in Iran and Lebanon. It also trained Palestinian engineers to manufacture weapons locally. The Second Palestinian Intifada erupted in September 2000, after the collapse of the so-called Middle East peace talks at Camp David and Ariel Sharon's unlawful visit to Haram al-Sharif, the home of the Al-Aqsa Mosque, the third holiest site in Islam. It was a major uprising by the Palestinians against the Israeli occupation that continued for 5 years. In 2006, Hamas won a huge majority in parliamentary elections, with Palestinian voters giving the group 76 seats in parliament out of the 132 seats available. After the Hamas victory, Khalid Mash'al visited Tehran and said, "Just as Islamic Iran defends the rights of the Palestinians, we defend the rights of Islamic Iran. We are part of a united front against the enemies of Islam." Unlike some other Palestinian groups, Hamas never recognized the occupation regime. So following the group's takeover of Gaza, a crippling blockade was imposed on the Strip to limit the movement of the people and goods, a collective punishment for electing an uncompromising group. put more pressure, the U.S. and its allies imposed sanctions on Hamas and the community the group represented. Many in the Arab world left the group high and dry, but the Islamic Republic, an all-weather friend, never withdrew its support for the group in the hardest of times. The Shia state gave a hand to the Sunni group to remind the Muslim world that Palestine transcends sectarian differences. On March 9, 2008, a Hamas senior commander, interviewed by the Sunday Times, said 300 of the group's best brains had been secretly sent to Tehran. According to the commander, who wished to remain anonymous, half are still being trained by the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps. They're learning how to make explosives from everyday items and produce more effective rockets. The rest have already returned